From WAMC in Albany, this is the Legislative Gazette, a weekly magazine about New York State government and politics. Your host is David Gustina, with political commentary by Dr. Alan Shartok, political scientist and professor emeritus at the University at Albany. Statewide distribution for the Legislative Gazette is made possible by New York State United Teachers, representing professionals in education and healthcare, online at nysut.org.
Coming up this week, Governor Cuomo says gun violence should be a key topic in the Congress and 2016 campaigns. Our political observer, Alan Shartok, shares his thoughts on whether the governor will run for a third term. And GE says it's completed its sixth and final year of dredging PCBs from the Upper Hudson River. Those stories and more on the Legislative Gazette. Governor Andrew Cuomo, who has been somewhat reticent about speaking out on the national stage, has lately been talking about the issue of gun violence, saying it should be a key topic in Congress and in the 2016 campaigns. The Legislative Gazette's Karen DeWitt reports.
Cuomo called into the New York City cable news channel New York One to talk about a potential hurricane, which later veered away from the East Coast. But quickly, the conversation turned to the recent mass shooting in Oregon and what to do about gun violence. The governor urged Democrats in Congress to make the issue a top priority and even adopt the GOP's tactics in an attempt to get a new gun control measure approved.
You have a congressional discussion where they want to shut down the government if the Republicans don't get a tax cut for the rich. I'd love to see the Democrats stand up and say we're going to shut down the government or threaten to shut down the government if we don't get real gun control legislation. It should be that high a priority.
Cuomo, who recently lost a member of his staff to gun violence, says the issue should be more prominent in the 2016 presidential campaign. But Cuomo says most politicians are afraid of the topic. The governor told Wolf Blitzer on CNN that there was a political cost after he led New York's efforts to adopt new gun control legislation. It was shortly after the Sandy Hook massacre in late 2012.
There is a segment of the population in New York, in this country, that is Second Amendment zealots, frankly, because there is no Second Amendment right for a mentally ill person to have a gun or for a criminal to have a gun, but they're Second Amendment zealots. And I passed the law, and I came down in popularity. And you know what? From my point of view, fine.
Cuomo says the state's gun control law, known as the SAFE Act, is working in New York, but without a national law, guns come in through other states. The head of New York's Republican Party, Ed Cox, does not buy the governor's premise for speaking out on gun control right now. Cox says Cuomo is using the issue to find a place in the national arena. He points out the governor invited Vice President Joe Biden to the state twice in recent weeks.
Everyone's talking about Biden getting into the race and with Clinton's polls dropping. The governor of New York seems to naturally look to the national stage, but you better be ready for it.
He says economic stagnation and political troubles in the Middle East are more pressing issues. Portions of New York's gun control law have been walked back since its passage nearly 3 years ago. A federal court ruled that a limit of 7 rounds of bullets could not be enforced, and that limit was up to 10 rounds. A provision to require background checks for sellers of ammunition has been indefinitely postponed. State police say they don't yet have the technology to carry it out. The majority of the law, including an extended ban on the sale of assault weapons and a mandatory registry of existing assault weapons, survived a court challenge and remains intact. GOP leader Cox says there are other ways of trying to curb gun violence. For instance, he says the media's recent practice of naming the Oregon shooter as little as possible could help discourage future mass murderers eager for attention.
This is something states need to deal with one by one and see what works and what doesn't work.
Meanwhile, frontrunner Democratic presidential candidate Hillary Clinton has intensified her focus on anti-gun violence. She held a rally in New Hampshire and is promising to try to close background check loopholes and allow gun violence victims to sue arms manufacturers. She says if she's elected president and Congress won't respond, she'll take administrative action. In Albany, I'm Karen DeWitt.
Joining us now, Legislative Gazette political observer Alan Shartok. This week started with a conversation you had with the Albany bureau chief, Alan, for Politico New York. That's Jimmy Vielkind. Really interesting conversation about whether Governor Cuomo would run for a third term. You were generally in agreement on some of the specifics, but on whether he would run or not, you weren't.
I truly believe that Andrew Cuomo is going to run for a third term because he has to. Look, he's a man who sees himself on the way up. If he goes, as Vielkind contends, to a, you know, a white shoe law firm, then he can't run. You don't run for president that way. I mean, he won't have the base. So he's got to go from somewhere. He's got to be a governor as long as he can, unless he has something better. And for the life of me, I don't know what he can find that's better. He can't, for example, be the Secretary of State, not prepared. He can't be the Attorney General. Doesn't have the legal chops for doing that. And so I don't see where he goes. He's sort of trapped, much like his father was when Mario ran for a fourth term. And it was a very dangerous thing then. Third terms, by the way, for governors, and Andrew knows this, have been extremely difficult to negotiate. Look, he got 1 million votes fewer in this last election than he did in his first election. So if you follow that trajectory, David, you will see that, you know, it's got to be worse. And his numbers keep going down. They were magnificent in the beginning. And now, as I think he thought was going to happen, they've gone down. Now, has he made mistakes? Yes. Does he know he's made mistakes? Absolutely. He took on the teachers union. There are millions of either teachers, ex-teachers, teachers' families out there. And I suspect that could have been the 1 million votes right there. They really hate his guts. And you talk to people and they'll tell you that. So now he's taking his education philosophy, which was very reformist, holding teachers accountable and testing everybody and Common Core. And he's saying, let's reexamine all of this. The question is it too late? If you tell teachers, basically, that you're not good enough and you need to be examined every so often and we're going to threaten your jobs, and then you come out and say, okay, maybe I was wrong. You don't even say maybe I was wrong. You sort of say we're going to revisit all of this stuff. Are they going to turn around and say, okay, good, now we trust you, now we like you? I don't think so.
One of the things you've praised Governor Andrew Cuomo over was the SAFE Act, the gun control legislation that was passed after the Sandy Hook school shooting in Newtown, Connecticut. One shooting after another, bringing us to Umpqua Community College in Oregon. Governor Cuomo used that tragedy to reignite the issue and says gun violence should be a key topic in Congress and the 2016 campaigns.
Well, let's put it this way. When every other politician, virtually every other politician, including Bernie Sanders, I have to say, is running from this, Andrew Cuomo has had the guts to come out and do it. Now, do I know what motivates him? No. Is it the fact that he, you know, wants to be out front on this because he thinks he can and it'll be good for him politically? I don't know. But he did it and he's doing it and that's good. You know, the whole thing sort of reminds me of a Chinese buffet, where you go and you see all these pots around and you say, I'll have some of that and I'll have some of this and I'll have some of that. Well, usually people get away from gun control because a lot of Americans have guns. I think I read somewhere that it's on average 2 guns per American. That's extraordinary. I may be wrong, but it's a lot of guns. And you got the NRA and you got all these groups. And after the Sandy Hook thing, he got out there and he did the right thing. And he said, we got to change this thing and we Americans are nutty. Sooner or later, it's going to turn out he was right about that. And he deserves credit. Look, as everybody who listens to this knows, you know, I'm not always enamored with the guy. But on guns, he deserves a lot of credit. And it's gutsy. And he is really, when he looks back at it, must have some reason to regret it, because upstate New York, which is very important to him and which he's always trying to garner their votes, have signs all over the place repeal the SAFE Act, which is the Cuomo Gun Act. So we'll see. But I do think that he's going to be proved in the end to be prescient about all of this.
Will the governor regret his ongoing feud with New York City Mayor Bill de Blasio?
Well, I got to say, he's stupid if he doesn't, because, you know, he looks like a bully. He sounds like a bully. And frankly, he is a bully when it comes to de Blasio. He should leave de Blasio alone. He's got his own problems. He's not doing well. But his need to fight with de Blasio, you know, there's a wag who said to me the other day, anything that's on any other politician's plate, Andrew thinks he owns it, and he sees this person as a threat. Well, he fought with everybody, fought with the controllers, now the most popular politician in New York, Tom DiNapoli, and he fought with the AG, Schneiderman, and by now he stopped all of that stuff. It was silliness. And he had no business, in my opinion, having this terrible row with the mayor of New York, Bill de Blasio, because, and I'll tell you why, because the guy's doing badly. Why does he have to take the onus for this? Well, people say, well, de Blasio's doing worse than Cuomo. So what? You know, Cuomo didn't need this. He shouldn't have done it. And I can tell you that there are people on his staff who feel the same way I do.
Legislative Gazette political observer Alan Chartok joining us. You are listening to the Legislative Gazette, a program about New York State government and politics. I'm David Gustina. General Electric says it has completed its sixth and final year of dredging sediment contaminated with polychlorinated biphenyls, or PCBs, from the Upper Hudson River. The Legislative Gazette's Dave Lucas has more.
GE CEO Jeff Immelt said in a news release Monday that the company met every obligation so far under the massive $2 billion federal Superfund project. Fairfield, Connecticut-based GE discharged PCBs into the Hudson River decades ago during a time when they were used as coolants in electrical equipment. GE spokesman Mark Behan.
The Hudson River dredging project really was an unprecedented environmental project and an engineering triumph in our view. EPA called it the largest environmental dredging project ever in the United States, and the completion they hailed as a historic achievement. And we brought the best of GE engineering and technology to the project, the size and scope of which had never been attempted before. We met every obligation and commitment on this project. We kept our word, and we're very proud of our work.
Some 2.75 million cubic yards of contaminated sediment has been removed from a 40-mile stretch of river north of Albany.
Our crews dredged the final bucket of sediment at 5:55 p.m. Saturday evening. They'll continue working into November as we lay down clean sediment in the areas that were dredged. The clean sediment is used as a basis for replanting underwater vegetation for use as fish habitat and food sources. And then for the next several years, we'll be monitoring river conditions to help New York State and EPA assess the benefits of the Hudson River dredging project.
Several environmental groups, including Riverkeeper, Scenic Hudson, and the Natural Resources Defense Council, want to hold GE's feet to the fire and keep dredging going forward. In a statement to the press, Riverkeeper staff attorney Abigail Jones is quoted saying, GE is living in an eco-imaginary world if it believes its dredging of the Hudson River is anywhere near complete. All of this puts the health of our families and the restoration of one of America's most precious resources at risk. Riverkeeper had no one available for comment today. Ned Sullivan is president of Scenic Hudson.
GE is leaving in place some 35% of the toxic PCBs that meet the standard for requiring cleanup, covering about over 100 acres of the river bottom. GE's liability is by no means complete.
Sullivan says at least two more seasons of dredging are needed for more suitable remediation. In late September, the U.S. Department of the Interior and the National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration sent a letter to the Obama administration complaining that GE's current plan would leave fish in the river unacceptably contaminated with PCBs. Dan Rochelle is a staff attorney with the Natural Resources Defense Council.
New information from federal agencies demonstrates that the river is going to be much dirtier and much less usable than expected at the beginning of the cleanup process. EPA needs to reassess the efficacy of the cleanup and ensure that it really meeting the goals that it initially set 12 years ago to protect New Yorkers and to protect the environment.
GE admits that the cleanup is far from over, but not as far as dredging is concerned. Behan says there is much more to be done.
We'll be monitoring environmental conditions for the foreseeable future to assess the benefits of the dredging project. We'll be focusing on the floodplains to assess whether PCBs are present in those low-lying areas along the shoreline, working with EPA. And we'll be continuing the cleanup of our Hudson Falls and Fort Edward plants. And we intend to bring the same standard of excellence that was brought to the dredging project to all of our continuing cleanup work on the Hudson.
The river will also be subject to constant monitoring, likely for many years to come. Ned Sullivan reiterates the need for additional dredging.
We are calling on EPA and Governor Cuomo to require GE to do this.
The Cuomo administration has backed away from commenting, which the Times Union reports is tied to the governor's ongoing effort to persuade GE to move its corporate headquarters to New York. The DEC and EPA did not return calls for comment in time for broadcast.
For the Legislative Gazette, I'm Dave Lucas.
The New York Racing Association has a new board member from Saratoga Springs. As the Legislative Gazette's Lucas Willard reports, local officials are praising the appointment.
Georgie Nugent Lucier was appointed to serve on the NYRA board in late September, and she says she's already studying up on the issues facing the organization that oversees thoroughbred racing in New York State. The Saratoga Springs resident says she rode show horses as a kid and fell in love with racing after moving to the Spa City in 2006.
You know, I kind of say this a little bit tongue-in-cheek, but I moved, you know, two furlongs from the Saratoga racetrack, and I became a fan by default. You either completely embrace it or, you know, you don't really pay attention to it, which is very difficult to do here in Saratoga. And so I fully embraced it.
The 39-year-old mother was appointed to the CDTA board in 2009 by then Saratoga Springs supervisor Joanne Yepsen. Now mayor, Yepsen said it's vital to have somebody on the NYRA board representing the city, where the track is a key economic driver. Lucier will also be the only woman on the board.
It's very important to have a woman on the board since there are none at this point, and it's very important to continue to look for other women that can serve this board well and serve Saratoga Springs well.
113th District Assemblywoman Carrie Warner recommended Lucier's appointment to Assembly Majority Leader Carl Hasty.
Everyone who's ever worked with her has indicated to me what a terrific leader she is. So I'm very excited about her service in this capacity and looking forward to working with her on the issues that matter to Saratogians about racing.
Lucier will attend her first board meeting later this month as the first full-time resident of Saratoga Springs since the departure of Charles Waite Sr. Waite, who left the board earlier this year, began working with NYRA in 1985 and served as co-chair of the Saratoga 150 celebration in 2013.
And I had the pleasure to meet Georgie this morning, and I think she's bright. I think she's enthusiastic. I think she's a passionate racing fan. In fact, she's the kind of fan that NYRA is trying to attract.
Among the issues facing NYRA, including racehorse retirement, anti-doping policy, and the impact of increased competition through casino development, many have been vocal about reprivatization of the board. Earlier this year, Governor Andrew Cuomo extended the reprivatization deadline from this month to next year. Facing falling revenues and leadership issues, the board was overtaken by the state in October 2012. Lucier said she's absolutely focused on privatization.
You know, I really look forward to reviewing the existing plan and having more conversations with the CEO and the rest of the board as to where that is and what we need to do to help that push that along. That's obviously a huge goal of ours, and that's what we were set out to do by Governor Cuomo.
Lucier's first board meeting is October 21st in New York City.
For the Legislative Gazette, I'm Lucas Willard.
Listening to the Legislative Gazette, a program about New York State government and politics. I'm David Gustina. For the first time in decades, the U.S. is undergoing a change to the Braille code used across the country. The Innovation Trail's Veronica Volk reports on how this affects blind students.
Starting the beginning of next year, all new Braille materials in the U.S. will be printed in an updated Braille code called Unified English Braille. This has been a long time coming. All other English-speaking countries have already adopted it, and the standard code used before was becoming more and more outdated. At the New York State School for the Blind in Batavia, instructors like Diane LeClaire have been trying to prepare their students for the eventual switch.
We're giving them the tools, and I think that's what we're really about. We want to give them the tools to be successful out there.
But they're not getting a whole lot of help on the state level. For example, even though this switch is supposed to be happening on a national level, no one's really sure how state tests are going to work after January. The New York State Education Department hasn't been clear about what code the region's exams will be in, and a spokesperson says they're still reviewing the transition. So, at the School for the Blind, they're trying to prepare students for anything. But there aren't that many education materials in Unified English Braille, sometimes called UEB.
The biggest thing is going to be probably the incredible amount of Braille materials that are currently Brailled already that will have to be rebrailed and changed over to the UEB.
To compensate, LeClaire and her colleagues are making their own learning materials, books, worksheets, and curriculums, all on these big Braille printers.
I think that's the final goal for us, is having our kids UEB ready.
Not all instructors are concerned about making the switch. Ann Parsons is a private tutor. She teaches adult students that are losing their vision. And some of them are deafblind, which has its own set of challenges. So Parsons says introducing them to a different code right now would do more harm than good.
I felt that to worry them with the differences between the UEB and the standard Braille would just confuse them. So I'm teaching standard code at the moment.
Parsons is a Braille reader herself who's been using the same familiar feeling code her entire life. She says she personally has no intention of switching, and she doesn't have to make sure her students pass a state test. At the School for the Blind, LeClaire says it's about more than just an exam. She wants her students to be competitive when they leave school. A study from the National Federation for the Blind from 2010 shows less than 10% of people who are visually impaired use Braille. In a world where your technology can talk to you, how important is it to know this sometimes cumbersome code that's expensive to teach? LeClaire says, for her at least, it's very important.
Those students who have become employable and have maintained their employability have been the high-functioning Braille-using students. And I think they realize that, you know, Braille is a necessity. It's literacy.
LeClaire says she hopes Unified English Braille will lead to an uptick in Braille literacy. In Rochester, I'm Veronica Volk for the Innovation Trail.
And that about does it for this week's show. We had help from the New York State Public Radio Network. For copies, call 1-800-323-9262. That's 1-800-323-9262. Ask for program number 1541 or just listen or podcast on the web at wamc.org. And join us again next week at this same time for more news on New York State government and politics. For the Legislative Gazette, I'm David Gustino.
Statewide distribution for the Legislative Gazette is made possible by New York State United Teachers, representing professionals in education and healthcare, online at nysut.org.